beautiful film star X uses Camay, we're told. Famous golfer Y smokes Embassy. The rationale behind adverts like that is not that these people are experts who know anything about soap or cigarettes. The real psychological appeal lies in the participation they encourage, in the glamour that these figures represent. Soap and cigarettes become a kind of sacrament whereby the prestige of the hero can be mediated to the admirer. Now, there's no more powerful lever on the springs of human motivation than appeal to a great example. Rational arguments may fail to convince us, powerful rhetoric may not move us, but a face that we admire and respect will rarely fail to simulate a positive response. Perhaps some of us can remember, though I can't, the First World War and that Lord Kitchener's picture, you know, Britain Needs You, what an impact it had. And this isn't just true of the 20th century, it was, if anything, more true of the mentality of the Greeks. For the whole of Greek history was the history of heroes. Ulysses and Hercules and Odysseus, we still read the mythology that surrounds them today. The Greeks were absolutely obsessed with hero worship. They knew there was no greater way of inculcating values than by personifying that value in the exploits of a great man. So what you see we have in chapter 11 of Hebrews is really a masterstroke of psychology. Remember that these Jewish Christians that this letter is written to were very much influenced by Greek thought. They came, in fact, from a group of Jewish, of Hellenistic, Greek-speaking Jews who were very used to long lists of heroes. Some of you maybe have heard read, perhaps at school, that famous passage from the book of Ecclesiasticus. Come, let us now praise famous men and our fathers who begat us. It's often read at school speech days and so on to try and inspire us to similar achievement, I suppose. Well, that passage in Ecclesiasticus comes from just the sort of Hellenistic Greek framework that these people that this writer of Hebrews is writing to. They were used to this idea of having heroes appealed to as grounds for human motivation. And so the writer of the Hebrews here uses the same sort of tactic. But he has a special goal in mind. You see, these Jews he's writing to were in extremely serious danger of falling away. It was becoming a dangerous thing to be a Christian. The Romans were now being able to distinguish between a Jew and a Christian. And whilst they were prepared to tolerate Jews, they were no longer prepared to tolerate Christians. Nero intended to stamp out this Christian superstition. And so it was becoming increasingly a temptation for these Jewish Christians to slide back into being Jews again rather than being Christians, because it was safer. What they needed, of course, was faith. Faith to persevere in their commitment to Christ, in spite of the challenge that was being directed against them from the world. And in chapter 10, which we've been studying over the last few weeks, the writer has used every device of homiletic skill to try and inspire that faith in his hearers. He's used exhortation in verse 24 of chapter 10. Let us not give up, he says. He uses warning in verse 30. The Lord will judge his people. He uses the memory of previous victory in verse 32. Remember those early days when you really stood your ground, he says. And he quotes from the Old Testament in verse 38, quoting from Habakkuk. The righteous man is a man who lives by faith, he says. He uses every argument he can think of to try to encourage these Christians, as they were in a hostile world and in danger of slipping away because of persecution, uses every argument he can think of to try and increase their faith. But in chapter 11, he really does come to a psychological masterstroke. He compiles this list of Jewish heroes. On the surface, superficially, it looks very much like that passage in the book of Ecclesiasticus about praising famous men. It's a list of the great Jewish heroes of the past, just as that list is, if you know it. But it's different. This list is not an exaltation in fame. This list is a glorification of faith. He's not holding up these men and saying, see what famous people they are, they were. Wouldn't you like to be as famous as they were? He's lifting up these men and seeing how much faith they have. Wouldn't you like to join that company of faithful men? who could resist the appeal of being in even in some small measure identified with Noah and Abraham and Moses? But he's not just encouraging us to share their glory. He's encouraging us to share their spiritual experience. Now, we're going to look at this chapter. We have to skip through it, of course, because it's a long chapter. We're just going to look at it under four headings. First of all, what faith is. Secondly, the difference faith makes to our understanding of the universe. Secondly, the difference it makes to our priorities in life. And fourthly, most important, the difference it makes to our attitude towards the future. But first, at what faith is. And he defines that in verse 1 of the chapter. Faith, he says, is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. So the first thing we have to say is that faith is an ability to perceive realities which are not detectable by the five senses. These realities, he says, may be hidden for two reasons. They may be hidden because they are spiritual as opposed to material, what he calls invisible things. Or they may be hidden because they are future as opposed to present, what we hope for, things hoped for. Faith is able to lay hold of both this category of things which are not detectable by the senses, and it doesn't grasp hold of them with an unsteady or a vague manner. There's an inner certainty about its perception. He uses two words here to convey this unhesitating quality about real faith. He says it is sure and it is certain. The Greek words convey the idea of reality and substance, proof and evidence. If you like, faith is, according to the writer here, very similar to a kind of sixth sense, a spiritual eyesight. Just as the human eye wrings assurance of visible reality and is able to recognize and dismiss anything fraudulent and illusory, in the same way, he says, faith grasps hold of invisible realities and is equally confident of its verdict upon them. It is sure. It is certain. It looks up beyond the material universe and lays hold of the invisible presence of God. And it looks forward beyond the uncertainties and the sufferings of present experience and lays hold of the unfulfilled promise of God. And really, this whole chapter really serves as an extended illustration of these perspectives of faith. The difference that having this eyesight of faith makes to the way we see things. First of all, the way we see the universe, he says, in verse 3. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Now, this is not something that's obvious to the man without faith, but it is something, he says, which is obvious to the man who has faith. He can see it, others can't. Several things to notice here, which are of importance. The first is the relation which faith bears to reason. You notice he says, by faith we understand. Faith then comes first. In recent centuries, Western man has given human reason priority. Knowledge acquired by logic or experiment is considered somehow more reliable, more certain than knowledge drawn from any other kind of human intuition. And so a dichotomy between knowledge and belief has come about. If I know something, I mean I'm certain about it. If I say I believe something, I usually mean I'm uncertain about it. Which is not at all the way this writer uses the word faith. The whole climate of thought in the West, really, that exalts human reason in this way is called rationalism. What we see here, really, is the demolition of rationalism as a method of understanding. The unbeliever in the Bible is not likened to a poor philosopher or faulty logician who can't work out what he believes. He's likened to a blind man or a fool who will not take notice of what's staring him in the face. In the face. In the face. Ah, he's better. Faith is an eyesight then. It gives us an intuition by which we then have to make, which we then make sense of by means of our reason. Faith informs reason. We believe in order to understand. That's the correct order. That's the correct way round. Another thing that's of importance that we can't really go into in the depth it deserves, that is implicit in this verse, is the notion that matter is not eternal. The writer here is quite convinced that our universe was not made out of pre-existent material. And in saying that, he breaks away from the ideas of the formation of the universe which were current in his day. He says it was not made out of material at all. As far as the categories of the scientists are concerned, the universe, he says, was made out of nothing, out of things which are not visible. The universe began with an act of creation, that is, an event which has a cause but no history. Nothing went before it. God did not make the world out of anything. He made it simply by his command. God said, "Let there be light." And with that sovereign fiat, time and the universe began. Now, the implications of this are very far-reaching, because as well as being essentially rationalistic in our 20th century, we're also essentially materialistic. Materialism is a religion that believes that matter is eternal, that material things are what ultimately determine the happiness and destiny of man. Now, the Bible rejects that. This writer here rejects that. Natural material things are temporary things, it says. They are not ultimate, they're not absolute. Heaven and earth pass away. What doesn't pass away is the word of the one by which they were created. The truth behind the universe then is not material, but spiritual. The universe didn't begin with an accident in matter, but a decision by God. Not a big bang, but a big person. And the evidence for this understanding of the universe, he says, is not to be found by looking down telescopes or sending up rocket ships. The one from whom our existence derives is invisible. He's undetectable to every human sense. Except that mysterious sixth sense, faith. For the man of faith, the truth of creation is not something he has to discover or work out or prove. It's simply self-evident. He sees it, and he is sure about it. That's the first difference, then, that this spiritual eyesight of faith makes. It makes a difference to the way we see the universe. We see it as a creation, whereas the unbeliever can see only nature. The second thing it changes is our priorities in life. It works a transformation here. Verse 6, without faith it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. See, the man of faith is inevitably going to be a man who has a passionate desire to please God with his life. Now, without faith, such an ambition is pointless. For two reasons. First of all, because an unbeliever, being insensitive to the reality of spiritual things, has got no perception of the reward that awaits a man who pleases God. So faith is necessary to motivate a man to seek God. But beyond that, says the writer, faith is necessary to such an ambition because God will not accept a man, will not be pleased by a man, except on any other business, on any other basis than that of faith. Righteousness, in God's eyes, insists this writer, is available only for men who have faith. And he gives us several examples here. Abel, Enoch, Noah, they were commended, he says, because of their faith. In Abel's case, it showed in his worship. In Enoch, with his daily walk with God. In Noah, with the holy fear of God's judgment he displayed. All these men were men of faith. And it was because they were men of faith that God was pleased with them. Not because they were perfect, but because they were believers. They were men who perceived the invisible reality of God and ordered their lives in accordance with that spiritual intuition they had. It's important, I think, to realize that the spiritual experience, which men in the Old Testament enjoyed is in no way inferior to that which is accessible to us, according to this writer. There's a continuity here. According to this writer, these heroes are not Jewish heroes. They're Christian heroes. The sort of faith they demonstrated is identical to the sort of faith we must demonstrate. The ability to look up and see beyond material things to the invisible and spiritual reality of God. But not only does it change our attitude to the universe, not only does it change our attitude priorities in life. But the most important thing, the thing which the majority of this chapter is spent emphasizing, is that faith, in addition to all these things, changes our perspective on the future. And this is an aspect of faith we don't often think about. Hope is a part of faith. Faith is able to look back and believe things about the past. Faith is able to look out and beyond this present universe and see things which are not there as far as material things go, but which are spiritual realities. But according to this writer, another perspective of faith is that it looks forward and grasps hold of what is not yet obtained, but which has been promised. And that aspect of faith, he says, begins with Abraham. Abraham's the first man who shows that dimension of faith. He was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance. He obeyed, even though he did not know where he was going. And he lived in that land which was promised to him like a stranger, not yet having actually obtained it. This is an example, he says, of this sort of forward-looking faith, which he describes in general terms in verses 13 and following. All these people, he says, were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. Now this, I suggest to you, is very relevant too to our present day. For if our present day is a world that's dominated by rationalism and isn't prepared to believe in all that it may understand, if it's a world that's dominated by materialism and is not prepared to believe that there is a spiritual reality behind what we see and touch and hear, if it's a world that has very little interest in pleasing God because it doesn't really believe that God is there to be pleased and has no conception of the reward that awaits those who please God, on top of all those things, our contemporary world is very much a world without hope. It's a world that simply despairs when it looks at the future. Nuclear holocausts and economic depressions and ecological disasters, the prospects are frightening. What a relevant word then to this generation of despair we live in, this chapter is, this vision for the future. The people of God, he says, are a pilgrim people. They're going somewhere. They're a people on a spiritual journey. They do not see this present world as anything more than an overnight stop, because their eyes are fixed on what lies ahead. He uses two words here to describe that in verse 13. Aliens and strangers. In other words, people who don't really belong, just passing through. There's a saying attributed to Jesus, actually. This world is a bridge. You must cross over it, but you must not build your house on it. Men without faith must build their houses here on the bridge of the world because they've got no other place to build it. If he looks for paradise, it has to be a paradise on earth. But the man of faith can lay hold of another country, a better city, a heavenly one, a place he will reach one day. He can't see it with his eyes, but that doesn't disturb him. He has the promise of a God who can't lie to rely upon. He sees it by faith. And it completely transforms his perspective on the future. See what difference it made to have this perspective on the future to these men that the writer goes on to describe from Abraham on throughout the book. The men of the promise. Before Abraham, faith was seeing God behind the material world. But from Abraham onwards, faith, in addition to that, was seeing the promise and looking forward to it and living in the light of it. And this is what it did for them. First of all, it made them men of adventure, like Abraham. Now, though he didn't know where he was going, the courage of this man, launching out, leaving behind everything familiar, always open to the new thing. But faith is like this, real faith. Faith that looks forward. It can never be hidebound by tradition, never nostalgic about the past. It's the future that excites real faith. He was looking forward to the city with foundations, he reads, whose architect and builder is God. one comes across sometimes people in church who are simply obstructive. And they're obstructive because of their obstinate insistence on clinging to the old. Sometimes people say, oh, they're very awkward. But often they're not awkward at all. They're simply unbelieving. Faith is never tied to the past. It's always looking forward for the adventure of tomorrow. Another thing this faith that looks forward did for them, it made them men of achievement. You see this in the life of Abraham. He was enabled, we read in verse 11, to become a father, even though he was as good as dead, and so Sarah herself was barren. See, Abraham, if he hadn't believed the promise, would never have even tried to bear a son, nor would Sarah. But faith can never be defeatist. Faith can never be paralyzed by past failures. Faith never surrenders to self-pity. Faith succeeds and goes on trying against all the odds. Why? We read, because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. The secret of Abraham's achievement was his faith. Another thing which this faith that looks forward enabled these men to do was to make huge personal sacrifices. You see one example of that in the context of the family in verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son. Children are precious, but faith does not hold on to them as if there could be no future for us without them. Men of the world may pin all their hopes on their children, but the man of faith pins all his hopes on the promise. Even the loss of a child is no great loss for one who believes in the possibility of resurrection, as Abraham did. You see another example of this willingness to make great personal sacrifice because of the vision of the future these men of faith had in Moses, in verses 24 and 26. This time not a sacrifice of family life, but of personal prosperity. He refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt. See, the world is obsessed with standard of living, with affluence, with prestige, with money. But faith isn't distracted by such tinsel. It knows that the only permanent treasures are treasures in heaven, and if occasion demands it, it will willingly sell all it has in order to invest in that vault where moth and rust don't corrupt. How was Moses able to make such sacrifices? Because he was looking ahead, we read, to his reward. There is something lacking, isn't there, in 20th century Christianity? There was a day when sacrifice was something that was taken seriously. People wrote books about it. Christian discipleship. Everything that we read was about Christian discipleship, one way or another. Now things have changed. We've become introverted. All the books we read are about personal devotional life. They're introspective. Self-obsessive, really. Self-interested, really. Perhaps they lack faith. Perhaps we've turned our eyes inwards. Perhaps what we understand by faith is some funny feeling down inside here, instead of an orientation towards the future, which is what this faith is all about. But I think most distinctive of all of the qualities that show up in this great list of heroes, which this writer is trying to bring out in this passage, the most distinctive quality of all which faith gave them was courage. Courage. You see it in Abraham. In his launching out. You see it in Moses' parents, who were not afraid of the king's edict. You see it in Moses, who left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. And you see it in many other of these instances too. Courage to face ridicule. How foolish those Israelites must have felt marching round Jericho with nothing but trumpets in their hands. courage to face danger, how they must have trembled to see those great walls of water on either side of them as they crossed the sea. But faith isn't deterred by threats or scorn or hazard because it's able to lay hold of the promise. Fear is an emotion of anticipation, essentially. The coward runs because he foresees a painful future. But faith sees beyond the possibility of suffering to the possibility of heaven. We do not lose heart, says Paul, for we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. And so the list goes on. Well, it could do, if the writer of Hebrews wanted to extend his letter any further. What more should I say, he says, about all these other characters? I've only got up to the middle of the book of Joshua. Time fails me to speak about the book of Judges and the book of Samuel and all the books of the prophets. Time fails me to tell you all about the Maccabees and what they achieved in the days between the Greek occupation. These people who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of flames, escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, who became powerful in battle, routed foreign armies, tortured, jeered, flogged. Others were chained, imprisoned, stoned, sawed in two. What a catalogue of heroism, a catalogue of adventure, of achievement, of sacrifice, of courage. This is what the men of the Bible are made of. And yet, you know, they all have one thing in common. Though they believed in the promise, though they were men of faith, they died. They died before they received what they were looking forward to. See that? They all died. Some died like Isaac and Jacob and Joseph in peace and honored old age. Some died like these prophets and martyrs at the hands of vicious torturers, but they all died, and they all died not having received the hope that motivated their heroism. Do you know why? The writer tells us in the very last verse. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made first. These heroes of the Bible died unsatisfied because God intended to add you and me to their number. That's why. You feel like a hero? Think you're the stuff that adventure and achievement and sacrifice and courage is made of? The secret of such Christian heroism is quite simple, says the writer. You don't have to be a great man. You don't have to be a famous man. The secret is faith. Being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. That's all it is. Faith that's able to see beyond material things to spiritual things. Faith that's able to see beyond the present problems and sufferings to the promise that one day is going to be fulfilled. I often think of that story from the life of Elisha, when the king of Aram tried to besiege Elisha in Dothan, and the servant of Elisha got very, very worried when he woke up in the morning, therefore, and saw all the chariots and the cavalry surrounding the city. What are we going to do? He said. Don't be afraid, said the prophet. O Lord, open his eyes. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the whole of the hills around were full of the Lord's horses. Chariot. If we want to be a Christian hero, that must be our prayer. Ask God to open our eyes, eyes of faith, to see what the world cannot see. If it did see it, it could be a hero too. Let's pray together.